They will regulate a militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thank you again for being a part of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. It is good to be with you once again. On the program in just a little bit, we're going to talk with John Stokes, a writer whose byline has appeared in a number of locations, talking about the quote-unquote buyback phenomena. You know, it started with Eric Swalwell, God rest his campaign, who said, you know what, we need to not just ban these firearms, these battlefield weapons of war. Oh, no. We need to buy them back as well. Mm-hmm. And then Swalwell ended up dropping out because that idea didn't really, you know, launch him into the stratosphere. So Beto O'Rourke's picked up on this idea. Oh, yeah. We need to ban and a buyback. Now, it's not a buyback. It's a compensated confiscation program. You know that. We'll talk about it with John Stokes. Some of the problems that would arise if, in fact, the gun banners got their wish. Now, gun control advocates are not going to get everything that they are asking for right now from President Trump. The concern is that they might get something that they're asking for from President Trump. NBC reporting that Donald Trump expects to be briefed tomorrow, or rather today, on a potential gun control package. Yeah, apparently having some meetings at the White House on Wednesday, more meetings today. One White House official talking to NBC said that President Trump was to be given summaries of the various ideas endorsed by members of Congress in the White House, but he won't be immersed in any specific legislative language. Well, the devil's in the details, particularly when it comes to red flag legislation. The broad scope of a gun ban or a magazine ban. Okay, that's bad. You don't need to get into the details to find the devil there. But when you're talking about red flag laws, again, I understand the impetus and the desire to say, listen, when there's somebody who's a danger to themselves or others in that most critical time, what can we do to ensure that they're not a danger to themselves or others? I just haven't found the red flag legislation that I think protects due process considerations, is more appropriate than the criminal justice system, or the existing civil commitment laws. And when you get into how these things actually work, it is absolutely critical that you get into the nitty-gritty details of, well, how long is a red flag order going to last? When is the first hearing going to be held? How easy is it to obtain a red flag restraining order? What level of judicial review is being used here? There are all kinds of legitimate questions, and in the 17 states around the country that have these red flag laws already in place, those standards vary wildly. Now, the federal legislation that Donald Trump is probably going to be taking a look at here in terms of quote-unquote red flags would not establish a federal red flag restraining order. I don't believe that anybody's out there writing up such a bill. Instead, it looks likely that this would provide grant money to states around the country that wanted to implement red flag laws of their own. But again, are you going? What are you going to have to do? What rules are you going to have to play by in order to receive that grant money? Is it going to be written so broadly that states can abuse due process, can abuse the Second Amendment rights of Americans, as well as the 14th Amendment rights of Americans, well, the Fifth Amendment rights of Americans? Or is this something that is going to be narrowly tailored, narrowly crafted, and something that gun owners might, I say might, be able to support in some way? NBC News also says the president, who spoke with senators advocating for, quote, stricter background checks, meaning expanded background checks, checks on more transfers of firearms that were currently required by federal law. He said that he was working with them to, quote, come up with something that is acceptable to everybody. He said, so we're looking at background checks, and we're looking at putting everything together in a unified way so we can have something that's meaningful at the same time. Again, I think the president is going to find it very difficult to get everybody on the same page here because many gun owners would look at an expansion of, well, who has to go through a background check, who has to conduct a background check when they're transferring a firearm. They would view that as problematic, as opposed to a measure like the Fix-Nix bill, which improves the records contained within the national instant check system, that's probably going to be much more acceptable and amenable to gun owners. But telling gun owners, hey, listen, you as a private gun owner have to go find an FFL who's willing to conduct one of these transfers, and you're going to have to pay for that transfer fee, and the individual purchasing or even borrowing that firearm from you is going to have to go through the background check. And then if it is a, you know, a temporary loan, you're going to have to go through the background check to get your firearm back. Again, paying an additional transfer fee. Gun owners are going to have a hard time with this, particularly when the penalty for not doing so is likely to be a federal felony. And we know darn well that violent criminals are not going to pay any attention to this law whatsoever. We also know, if the president is willing to do the research, that simply putting a quote-unquote background check bill on the books, even a quote-unquote universal background check bill on the books, doesn't lead to an increase in background checks. Garen Winnemute, who is a doctor out at UC Davis in California, is an anti-gun researcher. He did a couple of studies. I think Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, did a study as well about this in the past year or so. One study looked at California specifically. What happened when California put its quote-unquote universal background check laws on the book? What they found was that homicides did not go down. Suicides did not go down. Huh. Interesting. Another study took a look at what happened when Washington State, Colorado, and Delaware put their universal background check laws on the books. And what they found in that study is that background checks did not increase. Not measurably, anyway. Not in Washington State or Colorado. There was a slight increase in background checks in the state of Delaware. And the authors of the study didn't actually look at this, but I went back and I looked. So during that same time period, of those three states, Washington State, Colorado, Delaware, the state that saw the highest increase in its homicide rate was Delaware. The state that also saw, I mean, crime went up in all three states, but Delaware saw the highest spike in homicides. The state that actually saw an increase in background checks also saw the biggest increase in its homicide rate. But you can look at Colorado, violent crime up 25%, at least as of 2018, since the quote-unquote universal background check law was put on the books. Denver named the most dangerous large city, not the most dangerous, the largest city with the fastest growing crime rate in 2018, with their quote-unquote universal background check laws on the books. So it polls well, because most people don't understand what it is we're actually talking about. But trust me, Mr. President, if you're listening, this measure is not going to be nearly as popular as you might think it will be politically once we do start getting down into the nitty-gritty details. NBC News says that Senator Pat Toomey, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, said that they were told to expect something from the White House on Thursday, though the president had not specifically signaled what bills he was likely to support. Senator Manchin said, quote, it was a very engaging conversation for quite a period of time. Everybody was able to have their back and forths on this, and the president is still very encouraging. I believe he sincerely wants to move forward and do something. I hate that phrase. We're going to know, he says, hopefully by tomorrow, meaning today, if there's something that we can all agree on. And once we agree on something, we're going to hold to it and fight for it. So we will see what happens. Indeed, we will. We will not have long to wait, it looks like. In the meantime, now would probably be a very good opportunity for you to contact your senators and your Congress critter as well, member of the House of Representatives, and let them know where you stand. Be polite, be civil, but let them know where you stand on any new gun control proposals. Meanwhile, Rasmussen has a new survey out. And this is pretty amazing. So, you know, last week it was the San Francisco Board of Supervisors who passed a resolution declaring the National Rifle Association to be a domestic terrorist organization, right? Yeah. Well, now Rasmussen has polled this question, put it to the American people. And what they found is that nearly a third of Democrats believe it should be illegal, actually illegal, to join the National Rifle Association. Yeah, so here's the thing. I don't want to be too alarmist about this. I saw a poll a few years ago that showed 25% of Americans surveyed believe in Bigfoot. Okay. So if 28% of Americans, which is what Gallup found, say, 28% of Democrats, not even 20% of Americans, 28% of Democrats say, yeah. It should be illegal to join the NRA. Okay, that is not a majority of the country. That is not even a majority of the Democrat Party. Among all likely voters, 23%, Rasmussen said, favor declaring the NRA a terrorist organization in their home community. And 18% of all likely voters said that they think it should be against the law to belong to a pro-Second Amendment group like the NRA. Wow. Now, again, apparently more people believe in Bigfoot than actually believe that it should be against the law to join a group like the NRA or that the NRA should be declared a terrorist organization. That's the good news. Bad news is, really, one in five Americans say that they should, they should either declare the NRA to be a terrorist organization or it should be illegal. It should be illegal to join a group that protects and defends the Second Amendment. That's just amazing to me. So Rasmussen breaks this down among parties. You're going to get disappointed, by the way, if you think that it's a 0% on the right. 32% of likely Democratic voters favor declaring the NRA a terrorist organization where they live. 20% of independents, so again, one in five, and 14% of Republicans. 14% of Republicans say, I think we should declare the NRA a terrorist organization. 28% of Democrats say that Americans should be prohibited by law. So more than a quarter of Democrats surveyed by Rasmussen anyway, say that Americans should be prohibited by law from belonging to pro-gun rights organizations. 15% of Republicans say that. Huh? And 10%, just 10% of independents say, it should be against the law to join a group like that. I really wish that they had asked some open-ended follow-up questions like, why do you think that should be the case? But, you know, I do worry about this. I'm concerned that we are in a ban-happy mood in this country. You look at the Trump administration on Wednesday. We're going to ban flavored vapes, nicotine vapes, because apparently teens like them. Yeah. Birthday cake flavored vodka is still good, but the flavored vapes, bad. It just seems like right now we are at that moment in time where the first response by many people when they see something they don't like is, well, that shouldn't be allowed to do that. Right? Not, we should sit down and talk about this, or, boy, I really disagree, but you know what? I'm not going to do that. No, instead, we are really, I think we're so fed up with each other that we've just decided we're going to take it out on each other. And when we get the opportunity to actually deprive people of their liberty and of their freedom because we don't like what they're doing with it, we absolutely will do this. And I'm growing a little concerned this is a bipartisan phenomenon. You can certainly find elements of this across the political spectrum. It may be, when it comes to firearms, that it's primarily seen from the left at this point, but not entirely. Again, 15% of Republicans say that it should be illegal to join the NRA, or any other gun rights organization. Strange times we live in. Strange times. And again, we've got candidates out there like Beto O'Rourke calling for a ban and a compensated confiscation of firearms. Spoke with John Stokes. You I've seen at Open Source Defense, writing at Reason most recently about the quote unquote buyback and ban suggested by candidates like Beto O'Rourke, and why this would be so darn difficult to actually implement, even if the gun banners were to enshrine this into law. John, thanks so much for coming on the program, sir. It's good talking with you today.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. You've got a piece at Reason Magazine talking about the futility of a quote-unquote gun buyback, which is, you and I, and I'm sure our audience knows as well, is not really a buy back because the government didn't sell the gun in the first place. I prefer the term compensated confiscation, but understandably, the gun control advocates who are pushing these ideas, they like the idea of a quote-unquote buyback. It sounds friendlier. And you say that there are real issues about whether or not, even if something like this were to get passed by Congress, signed by a president, then you actually have to try to figure out how you would enforce such a mandatory buyback, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, even in New Zealand, which is not Texas, they had less than, I think, a 10% compliance rate for their mandatory buyback so far. And, it's really hard because fortunately for the New Zealanders, they also did not have an act. And this is one of these things where those of us that argue against the registry are like, uh-huh, yeah. So now that the New Zealand authorities have banned the AR-15 and banned semi-automatics, basically, they're having a hard time rounding them up precisely because they don't have a registry and they never had one. At any rate, if you look closer to home, if you look at New York, if you look at the New York SAFE Act that was passed in 2013, compliance rates are very, very low. I think they're estimated at well under 4% or whatever it is. It's really, really low. Just a few thousand of these weapons have been registered, and this is just a registration requirement. It's not sell them back. It's not turn them in. It's just show up somewhere and put the serial number in a registry next to your name. And people don't do it. And not only did they not do it, but the cops don't enforce it. The cops have been going on the record since 2013, talking to journalists, telling them, hey, you know, we don't enforce this. This is in rural New York. Now, you know, New York City is a different matter. But upstate is blue as New York is. The compliance rates are low and the police just aren't cooperating. So you can imagine what's going to happen if some sort of mandatory buyback is passed in federally. The other states, people are not going to comply. People here in Texas are not going to comply. The cops are not going to enforce it. In fact, I would imagine that we would see something like a statewide preemption. I wouldn't be shocked at all. Texas almost passed a law like that, I think, last year.
Well, I think that you would see, and it's interesting to see it, to think about the idea of a statewide preemption move, because we've already seen the rise of these quote unquote Second Amendment sanctuary communities around the country. I spoke with David Campbell, who's a commissioner in Effingham County. I think they were the first to pass a Second Amendment sanctuary resolution. And he says they now have over 500 towns and counties around the country that have passed similar resolutions. Most of them are symbolic at this point. But I think if you did see the passage of a federal gun law that said, all right, we're going to, you know, set up a spot here and you come in and you're supposed to hand over your guns, I think the number of those Second Amendment sanctuary communities would grow dramatically. Commissioner Campbell, as well as Cibola County Sheriff Tony Mace out in New Mexico, I spoke with him as well. And I asked, you know, so how would this work? Like, if there was a federal gun law that you felt was unconstitutional, would you guys just tell the federal government, hey, you know, you're welcome to enforce that law, but we're not going to lift a finger to help? And he said, yeah, that's exactly how this would work. You know, just as we see the sanctuary cities and sanctuary states when it comes to not working with ICE, you'd see that when it comes to, you know, working with DOJ or ATF or any other federal law enforcement agency that would try to enforce a law like this. And it's interesting because you point out at Reason, you know, you've had Meghan McCain say, listen, if people try to take these guns away, there's going to be violence. Tucker Carlson sort of doubling down on that. But I'm with you. I think actually the most likely scenario is simply massive and passive disobedience to any law like this that might be put on the books.
Yeah. You know, the Second Amendment sanctuary movement is led by local law enforcement, by and large. I mean, these are the guys that are actually pushing the sanctuary city stuff. So, you know, I think that gives us how a mandatory buyback would go down. You're right. I mean, this would spread, and even in places where the cops don't, and where local sheriffs don't come out and explicitly declare a sanctuary city, like again in New York, there's not a big sanctuary movement, that I'm aware of, and a lot of the counties going back to 2013, where the police are saying they're not going to comply. They're just lying. So even if they don't declare a locality a Second Amendment sanctuary, I can see them just not enforcing anything. So I think that's likely. And, you know, we had in Texas, and I think this has come up in, I believe, Missouri, a stab at a explicit state nullification of federal gun laws. There was a bill that did not pass, but I think it came pretty close. From what I recall, I would have to go back. But I think something like that would pass if there was a more elaborate ban. I think it would pass in more than just Texas and Missouri. I could see something like that passing in Louisiana, you know, Mississippi. A lot of these other states might explicitly say we're just going to ignore federal gun laws within the borders of our state.
Which, by the way, like, you know, in theory, I might be supportive of that, but at the same time, I also recognize that, you know, when you've got nullification issues, when you've got, you know, broad swaths of the country saying, no, we're not going to listen to the federal government on this, that's not great for the rule of law, right? But if you've got politicians that care less about the erosion of the rule of law and more about putting a largely unenforceable gun control law on the books so they can say they did something, you may very well see something like that come to pass.
Yeah, this cuts both ways. You know, I would say that, like, for instance, what New Jersey ignored the Firearm Owner Protection Act. They have a habit, their cops have a habit of arresting people who are lawfully traveling through New Jersey with firearms under protection of the act, which, as long as it's the arms are stored in a certain way, and locked in a trunk or what have you with ammo separate, you're supposed to be able to legally travel through any state, regardless of the local gun laws, and be protected. And New Jersey will just arrest you. And, you know, the NRA and other groups have brought suit over this. So that's an if of a state and of police ignoring a federal gun law. Now, it's a gun law that gun owners like. But again, it cuts both ways. And so if we open this Pandora's box of police and states ignoring gun laws, then this is the kind of thing that could come back to bite Second Amendment advocates, because you're going to end up with states like New Jersey that are going to be like, okay, well, if this is what we're doing now, if we're ignoring federal gun laws, then, you know, I don't really care what the Supreme Court said about what's legal, you know, assuming that, like, take, you know, one of these test cases goes through and the Supreme Court declares, you know, certain things, you know, bans and things unconstitutional. You know, maybe New Jersey just says, you know, we don't really care what the Supreme Court says. We don't care what the feds say. We're doing our own reverse Second Amendment sanctuary thing here. You know, if Texas wants to ignore federal laws, we're going to ignore federal laws. So you can get some of that. And then also you just get a situation where, like, yeah, as you pointed out, this seems kind of corrosive of the rule of law. It doesn't seem good. So it
doesn't. But at the same time, again, I understand why it's happening. You know, and we do have, I think you look throughout U.S. history, and there are certainly plenty of times where, you know, broad swaths of the populace have found a law to be unjust, and they've decided, I'm going to disobey, right? Whether it's the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1850s or Prohibition in the 1920s or even what we're seeing now with, you know, states legalizing cannabis at the state level, while it remains a Schedule I narcotic at the federal level, and it's illegal at the federal level. I mean, heck, John, we might even see this in terms of vaping here before long, given the new rules that President Trump has announced. So, it you know, again, I don't think it's necessarily great, but I understand why it happens, and I think the better alternative is to avoid putting these really bad, obtrusive and unconstitutional and ineffective laws on the books in the first place. That's the best way to avoid that corrosion.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, one is, yeah, don't pass gun laws that are dumb and unenforceable and that no one is likely to comply with and that turn ordinary people into felons and then expect that we're going to still have the same level of rule of law that we had before you did that. That's one. And another is I think there's a larger renewed movement towards what people are calling localism, where local communities and local community norms and laws kind of start to start to take a little more precedence over things that are federally enacted. I mean, we have now a situation, the country is very large. You know, there's 300 something million people in the country. It's large. It's really ideologically divided. There's a lot of city versus country divide, even within states. It's not just the states, the state houses and the different counties are at odds with one another. And that's what's so difficult to get one's head around as I try to game this out. It's not just about Washington versus Texas. It's about Houston and Dallas versus, counties immediately adjacent. Those are real divides. It's about Chicago versus the rest of Illinois. And frankly, it's about LA and the Bay Area against the rest of California. So you have these sort of, dense urban population centers, and they want to make one set of laws. And then the people that are a bit more rural want to live under another. And that's a conflict that doesn't go away, even if we have a big return to states' rights. Then it just kind of moves the problem to the state houses. And, you know, I don't have a good solution there, but it looks like this local sheriff county nullification thing on the left and the right, when it comes to ICE and immigration, when it comes to marijuana, when it comes to guns, it looks like that's kind of a bottom-up workaround for this problem.
Or at least I don't even know if I'd call it a workaround, but it's a phenomenon that I think is going to continue to grow, particularly if, you know, bad laws get put on the books. And it's interesting because, you know, you talk about that tension within the state. And while so far we've heard a lot of Democratic presidential candidates talk about the idea of a ban and a quote unquote buyback, it'll be interesting to see if any of the really anti-gun states adopt something like this. California has an anti-gun supermajority in the legislature, for example, and Gavin Newsom loves himself some gun control bills. Governor Phil Murphy in New Jersey has said, I'll sign anything that gets to my desk if it deals with gun control. So, you know, we would have to wait until 2021 to see some sort of federal ban and quote unquote buyback. But I'm curious if we'll see any lawmakers in some of the more vociferously anti-gun states introduce a ban and a quote unquote buyback, you know, in the next couple of months at the state level.
I think that that whether that happens and the timing of it, it's going to depend on, to some degree, on events on the ground. I mean, if we have another spate of these shootings with ARs, you could be right. And that's the thing that's tragic, is these things are driven. It's ironic to have this conversation on 9/11. As we're doing, because that was one of those things where you had this really high profile mass casualty attack that drove a lot of policy and a lot of like civil liberties curtailments that in the end weren't like directly related to preventing that again. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. There's a kind of an overreaction and overreach that we all go through, and you can use these kind of attacks and these kind of like high psychological impact, low casualty attacks. And I'm not trying to downplay, 9/11. I'm just saying that that's the reality, is that you can use these to drive policy and legislation that may not be a real fit in the name of safety. And so, yeah, if we have another spate of attacks, then sure. I mean, that could happen. And what will be really interesting is to see what the Supreme Court does. If this this so-called conservative majority, how pro-gun they really are, and are they gonna uphold a ban on a weapon that's as in common use as the AR-15 is?
Well, so far we've seen them avoid taking up any challenge to a quote unquote assault weapons ban, whether it's Illinois or Maryland or California's. But they are going to have some more opportunities going forward. We know that in just a few weeks, they're going to meet in conference to figure out what they're going to do with that New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City case, which is dealing with transporting firearms. But, I think it's pretty clear the court is going to weigh in on a Second Amendment case at some point in the near future. You're right, though. This is one of the questions that the court has so far managed to avoid. And I think they can only do that for so long. I think sooner or later, they're going to have to actually reckon with whether or not you can actually ban the most commonly sold rifle in America today, given that the court has already said that, you know, firearms that are not covered under the Second Amendment are those that are considered dangerous and unusual. So is the most commonly sold rifle in America today really all that unusual? I would say no. I'm sure you'd say no as well. Gun control advocates would say, yeah, absolutely it is. It needs to be banned. I'm curious. I mean, do you think, John, by the time, because right now, again, we're hearing these calls from a lot of candidates who seem to be trying to out anti-gun one another, and we have not even reached the first primary yet. Do you expect that, let's say, by the time Election Day 2020 rolls around, you'll see the Democratic standard bearer having gone past even a ban and a buyback and just calling for outright confiscation? Or do you think that's still a third rail for politicians right now?
I think it depends on who that standard bearer is. I don't think that Joe Biden is going to call for a buyback or even a ban or any kind of confiscation. I think that he may make some mouth noises about gun control, and then he'll try to do some token thing. And, you know, when it fails, he'll be like, well, I tried, you know, I did it. And, the guy, he appears to be so mentally confused, you know, who knows? He may not know what state he's in. He may be like, we really got to ban the Saturday night special. That's the most important thing, is these and the cop killer, the Black Talon bullets and the Saturday night special. We really got to get those off the streets. I don't expect a real effort from him. Now, I also wouldn't expect a real effort from Sanders. Like, something Sanders may try, he may go a little further than Biden. I think when you get to like Warren is where you get into like somebody that might seriously make a big push at a ban or a confiscation or a buyback or something like that. You know, she's kind of gone into full blown pander mode on a lot of issues. So I don't know. It's hard for me to parse out how much of her current bandwagoning on this is pandering, and how much of it is like, you know, deeply held belief, or how much of it I should set my expectations that she'll do something involving executive action or something like that. I don't know. But I think there's kind of a break point, you know, where when you get down to Warren, she might try something. I don't think that any other candidates that are polling in the single digits are worth talking about right now. So, you know, I mean, O'Rourke, you know, the guy's not going to, he's never going to be president. He's just trying to get a little more airtime and try to stay on. He's trying to stay on the debate stage. But, you know, I think really the top ones are the ones that we should be thinking about.
Yeah. Well, what about to that? What about Kamala Harris? You think she would? I think she, like Warren, would be very, very eager to try to take, you know, that type of action.
Yeah, I would estimate her likelihood of doing something really dumb, like with an executive order that has a lot of blowback. I would estimate that to be higher than Warren. Warren is at least has like a legal background and sort of knows that a lot of this rule by executive order stuff is bad. And I'm somebody that thinks that it's bad regardless of who does it. I don't care, you know, what party. I think this executive order stuff is toxic. And I would hope that Warren might know that or have some sense of that. Harris, though, you know, Harris is a different matter. She may do exactly what she claims she wants to do. Who knows?
Yeah, you may be a little bit more optimistic about Elizabeth Warren than I am. I see, you know, as you say, she's in sort of full blown pander mode at the moment. If she were to be elected president, it would be interesting to see how much of that was, you know, campaign bloviation versus the real deal. But I suspect that Warren, too, particularly when it comes to guns, I think that would probably be one of those issues where she might put her principles, even if she had, you know, principled objections to executive overreach, that might be one area where she'd be willing to put that aside and say, all right, you know what, let's just go ahead and do this with guns, and we'll deal with the aftermath later. John Stokes, again, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. It's always good talking with you, and hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And by the way, last time, the first time we talked, you had knives behind you. This time it's books. So next time, can we do like your chainsaw collection? Can we have that as your backdrop?
Sure. Yeah. Axes, something like that. Yeah. Absolutely. Out front of my tractor, I'll set something up. So.
Ah, perfect. All right, man. We'll talk to you soon. All right, let's get to our armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and, of course, a look at the failures of our criminal justice system. In fact, we will begin there with a case out of Texas, but also out of Colorado as well. We were talking about Colorado earlier in the program. So there was a guy arrested in Texas for basically suspicion of murder and the death of a man whose body was recovered on I-25 in Erie, Texas, covered in plastic bags. As it turns out, though, this guy was very recently in the crosshairs of law enforcement up in Colorado. Orlando Lujan has been arrested in connection with the death of 39-year-old Gene David Cisernos, who was shot in Denver on August 29th. He's also being held for investigation of motor vehicle theft, which he allegedly committed that same day. 8 days prior, August 21st of this year, he had been sentenced to probation in Arapahoe County District Court following a motor vehicle theft conviction. According to records there in Arapahoe County, Lujan had committed the first motor vehicle theft on July 25th. In that case, he entered a plea deal in which six charges included a misdemeanor count of carrying a concealed weapon. Yeah, and two felony car theft charges were dismissed. So two felonies, poof, disappear. Weapons charge, poof, disappears. And instead, Lujan pleads guilty to much more minor charges. And also a criminal charge or a charge of criminal possession of financial devices for more than four different people, also dismissed as part of the plea deal. Huh, how about that? Lujan, not a stranger to the court system. Colorado Bureau of Investigation background check showed that Lujan has an extensive criminal record, including a conviction for robbery in the state of Colorado. Despite his criminal history, he's still getting sweetheart plea deals, right? Including the dismissal of two felony charges, which put him out on the streets, and according to police, allowed him to kill a man and then apparently drive the body there down to Texas. It's an unbelievable story. But unfortunately, again, we see stories like this in the criminal justice system each and every day. Now let's get to our armed citizen story from Henderson, North Carolina, where authorities say a man trying to break into a home in Henderson was shot and killed early on Monday. Police responded about 2 o'clock Monday morning to reports of a attempted break-in. They found a man dead outside a window to the home. Preliminary investigation showed that the individual was trying to break in when somebody inside the home shot him. No charges have been filed. Shooting does remain under investigation at this point. Neighbors say they aren't sure what could have made the home a target, except there was an empty TV box sitting outside on the porch. One woman who asked not to be identified said, I was just shocked. I came out when I saw the police. That's when I realized someone was lying on the ground dead. Woman said she talked to one of the people who lived in the home, and she said that they were trying to kick in the back door. She said they couldn't get in the back door. They decided to come around the front. Her boyfriend shot through the glass through the bedroom window, and it hit one of the boys. The neighbor says she doesn't think anybody inside that home should face criminal charges. She said, I guess he was trying to protect his family because it's her and the two little twin boys in the home. Well, we will keep an eye on this story. We'll give you any details as they become available. But, yeah, you know, you do have the right of self-defense. It is a human right, and it would be shocking to me if, based on the facts that we know now, if there weren't additional contributing factors, it'd be a shock to me if the individual inside that home faced any charges for this. Meanwhile, our good deed of the day from Wisconsin, the Capital State Journal noting a retired Dane County Sheriff's detective ended up helping to chase and subdue the suspect in a shooting on the north side of Madison earlier this week. It's a crazy story. Retired detective was there in the area shortly before noon on Monday. And he said he watched a young man fire multiple rounds at a car. So the retired cop and a State Department of Justice agent who was also there chased the suspect. Ended up taking him into custody with the help of Maple Bluff police officers. 17-year-old Turquil Davis was arrested. His revolver was seized. He was tentatively charged with first-degree reckless endangerment, and possession of a firearm by an adjudicated delinquent, meaning that the 17-year-old, no stranger to the law as well. Detectives learned that Davis is in the midst of a dispute with a couple of other young men. He was walking when those young men pulled up near him in a car. The detectives located the car, which had two bullet holes, no reports of any injuries, but no sign of those individuals either. So, sounds like, again, you got another case of an individual who is not paying any attention to the existing laws that are on the books. What makes you think that another four or five more laws would make a difference for this young man? All right, that is all the time we've got for you here on this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Have I was going to say it was a special treat, but I don't know. It could end up really badly. But we have an experiment on Friday's Cam and Company. We'll be coming to you from the Town Hall Media offices in Washington, D.C. First time we're going to try to take this show on the road, hoping to have our good friends, the hosts of Triggered, Storm Paglia and Matt Vespa, with us on the program. We'll have all of the day's latest headlines as well. So we'll see you tomorrow. Hopefully everything goes well. We'll see you tomorrow with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company.